This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It was a volatile week for markets, thanks in large part to uncertainty over the emergence of a new COVID-19 variant, Omicron, which we're still trying to figure out how to pronounce. I think we figured it out.
I talked to our Greek colleague here, and she told me.
We got it now.
Mr. Lanny Gafopoulou. Also, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell taking a hawkish tone before Congress, vowing to keep inflation in check, and saying, Carol, that Fed officials should consider tapering asset purchases even faster than anticipated, setting the stage for potential interest rate hikes next year. But as you always remind me, interest rates, they're low.
We need perspective, everyone.
Exactly.
The other thing is, and this caught our attention, he said it's time to retire the word transitory when it comes to rising prices, a trend we are seeing in nearly every sector of our economy. And several of our guests on this program have plenty to say about that, Tim.
Well, coming up in this broadcast, we're going to hear from a pair of e-commerce experts from different sides of the aisle. Shopify president Harley Finkelstein tells us how his company is outpacing the broader retail sector with the holiday shopping season already underway.
And talk about timing. Wall Street Journal tech columnist Christopher Mims, he's got a new book out about exactly how we get all of the stuff that we have and why the global retail industry is at a tipping point.
Plus, the Bloomberg 50 is back. It's our annual look at the people and ideas that defined global business, entertainment, finance, politics, science, and technology in 2021.
I love this list. All of that to come. We begin with a story in this week's economics section. Supply chain carnage creating opportunities. Yes, opportunities for companies willing to take a chance on random goods. From cheese to used cars and maybe even pumpkin seeds. Think of it as storage wars on steroids.
Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Jeff Wise wrote the story, and he joined us along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. Jeff tells us his piece came from his coverage of the Ever Given. That, of course, was the monster cargo ship that clogged up the Suez Canal back in March.
Nobody really knew what was on that ship. You know, there were something like 20,000 containers, and there were various reports. Like, it had been reported that there was a life-size Tyrannosaurus Rex that was heading for a mini golf course in England. But like nice little details like that. But nobody really knew what the bulk of it was. And there was this young guy in the UK who was more talkative than most of these salvage buyers, and he kind of became like sort of an instant media star over in the UK. He was on the local news and everything, talking about what he had taken about 20 containers off the ship and was trying to, you know, figure out what to do with it. He had actually 10 containers, I think like 200 tons or something, of raw cabbage that had been picked by farmers in China, put in these containers, and was destined for Europe. And then, of course, it was stuck for 4 months.
So it was kimchi.
In the heat.
Inadvertently.
And it had liquefied. It had turned into goop. And so this is a guy who, you know, became the centerpiece of my article for Business Week. You know, he can both turn around stuff that has some value left in it, or he can take stuff that's absolutely toxic or dangerous or whatever. It has to be disposed of. So he whatever it is, he kind of uses his cleverness and his connections to find out the best thing to do with it.
And how is it that you know, in 2021 that, you know, these could be mystery boxes? Isn't it, don't the companies that transport these containers know exactly what's in every container?
For the most part, yes. Each container has a manifest, and it's sealed, and so there's not supposed to be any tampering, but there's shenanigans that go on, and sometimes the manifest is vague. In the case of the one that I wrote about in the story, it just said household goods, bracket, car. And they're like, what that meant was anybody's guess. Like, what value do you assign to that? It's like a complete, you know, random guess. But he would tell me sometimes, this wasn't in the article, but there's a trade where people basically, because it costs money to dispose of stuff, especially dangerous stuff. So what they'll sometimes do is they'll bundle up, you know, correctly, say plastic recycling in the front of a container, and then behind that, it's like either just junk or garbage or something hazardous. and then you ship it, you know, to Asia or to Africa, and then it's you know, effectively you're disposing of it. The same day I was there, he showed me the car. He had a load of tires that had been illegally shipped off and had been sent back, and so he was going to dispose of that.
So I understand why someone might not claim 20 containers full of what was formerly known as cabbage,
right.
But why would something like that car not get claimed? Like how frequently does stuff just not get claimed at the port?
He is not a detective. His job is just to figure out what to do with this stuff, and he, like, the quicker he can do it, the better. So yeah, my instinct is the same as yours. I'm like, how do you? But that's not his approach. So he doesn't know. Like, he has no idea what happened. This guy could have died. He could have just, like, looked at the storage charges and been, I don't want to deal with this anymore. But this is a real problem. You know, the containers sit there, and whatever's in it is not gaining any value, and the costs are mounting. I actually wound up, I was over in the UK doing a couple of stories, and I wound up sharing a cab with a woman whose son was in the furniture importation business, and she was telling me he was looking at, he might go bankrupt because there's such a shortage of truck drivers. Because of Brexit, all their truck drivers left, and they have a real problem. They just can't move stuff. And the longer it sits, you know, the worse the problem gets.
That was Bloomberg Business Week contributor Jeff Wise, along with Business Week editor Joel Weber, with an inside look at what happens when supply chains, well, they go haywire.
And while not everything we order arrives on time, we still really do expect them to. Coming up next, we're going to explore how consumer demand for that instant gratification is transforming global commerce and displacing millions of workers at the same time.
Wall Street Journal tech columnist Christopher Mims details his new book and gives us a firsthand account of the pandemic's immediate impact on trade in the early days of 2020.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, not a day, not an hour seems to go by without us talking about the global supply chain. It certainly came up a lot this past week on Capitol Hill between lawmakers and Fed Chief Jay Powell. Shortages and delays persisting even as the federal government works to ease these pain points.
Our next guest started writing a book before the COVID lockdown that revealed how our supply chain could be brought to its knees. And his trip to Southeast Asia in early 2020 ended up coinciding with the onset of the deadliest pandemic we've seen in more than a century.
Wall Street Journal technology columnist Christopher Mims recently released this book, Arriving Today from Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy.
The process was already in motion once COVID-19 came around, and the crisis did little to change consumer expectations of convenience. It solidified demand for services that could provide the instant gratification that many of us have come to know and rely upon.
Mim set out to understand the rapidly advancing technologies that are changing the way goods are transported and displacing workers in ways we've never seen before. And it was all sparked by his interest in the world's e-commerce king.
It really came from witnessing the transformation in terms of automation and other types of technology that was happening in supply chains because of Amazon. And I just thought, okay, you know, if e-commerce is going to become the dominant way that we buy things, this is going to be huge for millions of American workers and for every single one of us, because, you know, we're all consumers. So I wanted to understand how those supply chains worked, because it was clear that they were undergoing a transformation unprecedented since the invention of the shipping container.
It's safe to say that we all just expect stuff to show up at our door. We don't really think about the process. We've gotten so removed from it for many of us. There are a lot of workers that are the backbone of our supply chains, but for many of us, we're removed from it, right?
Yeah, we're so removed from it, and we're even more removed from it than we used to be because of globalization. The supply chains are longer than ever. So when they get disrupted, we kind of throw up our hands and we're like, what's going on?
We talked about when you started to write this book before the pandemic. So just take us back to that time in January of 2020 when you were exploring supply chains in Asia. What did you end up finding out, especially as the pandemic began to ravage the globe?
Well, what I witnessed was really the supply chain disruptions and the congestion that we're seeing now. So, you know, I was standing on the quayside in Vietnam when goods are being loaded, just as the World Health Organization announced that there was, you know, an issue in Wuhan, China. And then, it was inadvertent on my part that the book coincided with the pandemic. But, you know, as I sort of followed the journey of those goods all the way to the U.S., I ended up, you know, in places like, FedEx sortation facility, talking to the head of automation at FedEx about how what used to be the holiday peak was now every single day, and that they were anticipating that when the holidays did arrive, they would have what they called peak on top of peak. So you had this system that was really sized for, you know, maybe a holiday peak that was then having to do that holiday peak just as part of its normal line of business. You know, I also rode along with a UPS driver, you know, who told me that, you know, she was really keeping her everybody on her route supplied with, you know, everything from the goods to homeschool their kids to, you know, food and other things that they were ordering that were being delivered through UPS, and that every day she was as busy as she would normally be during the holidays. But of course, this was, you know, nowhere near the holidays. So the entire system now has had to expand to accommodate what used to be its maximum capacity.
Hey, Chris, I too have ridden along with a UPS driver. Talk about being impressive. And they have technology and data to make sure that, you know, they are aware of everything they do, how long it takes, and keeping track of it. It blew my mind. Having said that, so when you look at all the work that you did and really understanding the nitty-gritty details, the technology, the logistics, the people behind our global supply chain, do you clearly understand the mess that we're in today?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, fundamentally, this gets to the heart of, you know, the most important macroeconomic indicators, which drive everything, you know, the entire stock market. Like, the reason that we're having inflation that the Fed cannot deal with right now is we're having a supply shock. The reason we're having a supply shock is that we're having congestion in the supply chain. And part of that congestion is due to the labor crisis. We don't have enough people to drive the trucks to move all the containers out of all these ports. So, you know, Maersk's chairman just said they had more than 80 ships waiting on average 18 days at ports all over the world, but in particular on the West Coast. So the shocks and the bottlenecks at every one of these junctures in the supply chain, I think, are key to understand, because these seemingly small things are what are driving ultimately, you know, inflation. And I think a lot of investors' fears that this new coronavirus will, you know, hurt the economy and hurt the stock market.
Chris, do you think that the era of just in time, when it comes to the way that companies think about getting us our goods, the era of globalization, do we see any permanent shifts or changes to those things as a result of the pandemic and what we've learned?
I think you're seeing a lot of smaller manufacturers and retailers are having to stockpile more goods. So in that way, you know, this era of lean everything is over for a lot of retailers. And, you know, the biggest ones that are reporting that the supply chain is starting to clear for them, like Target and Walmart, they're the ones who order well in advance. So in some ways, I think, you know, just in time, you know, is disappearing. That said, you know, as soon as this supply chain backlog clears, it could be as early as next summer, you know, I think people will return to that, because, of course, it just drives more returns on everything, returns on capital. Nobody wants to have a bunch of goods
right
tied up in inventory if they can avoid it.
Right. But you think about those balance sheets and how they would change. You know, it's funny. I grew up with, I guess you would say, kind of depression era parents, or parents who grew up with families that, you know, had to deal with the depression. And we always had a utility room that was stock full of so much stuff. But I think they remember, you know, when there were lean times and you couldn't get stuff. And I do wonder the impact that this will have on all of us going forward, or perhaps our families going forward, and maybe companies, as you just talked about, you know, going forward.
So absolutely. I think people are at every node of the supply chain, which, by the way, includes us, includes our individual households. You know, people are being forced to stockpile more goods. And yeah, those depression era mentalities, they don't go away.
That was Wall Street Journal technology columnist Christopher Mims. He breaks down the wide world of supply chains in his new book, Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy.
It's about logistics. It's about technology. More importantly, it's about the people being affected by these changes to the global business landscape. Millions of workers will be shouldering the burden as we move toward a fully automated system.
I think what's notable too, Carol, is the consumer expectation side of this. We've all become accustomed to getting things so quickly, regardless of where they come from.
What's interesting, and I think about this in the pandemic, right? We learned so much about how a vaccine is made, right? Because we've been living it in real time, and every data point, every research study, every, you know, vaccination that comes out, we've learned about it. Same thing for the global supply chain. We just expect stuff to be there. And now we're like, well, wait a minute, what's that process of, you know, from start to finish? And we're learning so much more about how complicated it is, and really, truly, how global it is. As most people say, you can't go back. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, a dispatch from the epicenter of the Omicron variant of COVID-19, South Africa.
An executive from De Beers explains how the world's largest diamond company is adapting to the new threat and what it means for the company's bottom line. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Like most companies involved in the retail space, De Beers has had to pivot and adjust to changing consumer tastes and trends during the pandemic.
And the world's biggest diamond company now has a new challenge to deal with. The latest COVID variant has taken root in Southern Africa, where many of its key mines are located.
We were fortunate enough to catch up with Pat Dombey, VP and Head of Corporate Affairs and Government Relations at the De Beers Group of Companies, just as word that the Omicron strain had begun to circle the globe.
Pat joined us while in transit from South Africa to neighboring Botswana, telling us that regional travel restrictions were unlikely to hinder business as usual.
It's one of the important aspects of the success of our partnership with the South African government and the Botswana government. It's interesting because they both reported at the same time. They have a very good working relationship, particularly when it comes to the border, because a lot of us come from both countries, like myself.
Right.
The importance of adaptability, I think that the private sector with government are working together. And for us as a business, as you rightfully say, Carol, it's been having to really figure out how to be adaptable, mm-hmm. And how do we refine and be agile in this market. But I think we've done it. And I think that our whole focus is really focusing on our employees and, of course, the communities in which we operate are really critical, and that's also very important to our partnership with the government.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, demonstrating the importance of managing COVID with them.
Right. Tell us about the business right now. Do you guys have all the workers that you need to do what you need to do? How has the relationship with consumers changed as a result of the pandemic?
Sure, Carol. Well, it's interesting because we're actually pretty excited. We had, the beginning was a little bit tough for everyone in 2020, but mm-hmm. Based on our adaptability and being able to refine and look at what it meant to continue our business, we ended with a pretty good year in 2020. And now, going into the holiday season, we're looking at some of the data that's been coming out, like sources, Eden Golan, Diamond Research and Data, that are reporting that U.S. jewelry sales advanced to a stunning 41% from January through May, totaling about $32 billion. So that's up by about $23 billion in the same period pre the pandemic.
Hmm.
So that tells us a few things. It tells us that American consumers want to celebrate life and each other a little differently. I think you said that a little bit earlier in the program. And they have a real strong love, more importantly, for diamonds, especially at this time of the year.
Help me understand and help our audience understand where your job comes in when it comes to transparency and sustainability and helping consumers understand that the diamond that they are buying is one that they can feel good about. It's one that was mined sustainably, it was mined in a conflict-free way, and it wasn't mined using labor practices that, for lack of a better term, aren't appropriate.
Well, thank you for that question, because it really is paramount to everything we do. And it's something that, as a person from Botswana, that I'm really proud of our company. We definitely believe in sustainability, and we've invested heavily in innovation and technology as a link to that. We've created a sustainable framework, which we call Building Forever, and it says exactly what it means. It's at the heart of what we do.
Tim and I talk about this a lot, whether it's wife or friends that he knows that aren't necessarily into diamonds. It's just different. I look at my daughter, I look at, you know, different individuals that maybe aren't into jewelry that like my mom was, or even myself. Is it translating and reaching the newer, younger consumer?
A very good question. Well, what we're seeing is that through our insights research, we're seeing a generational shift, as you rightfully point out, with consumers, particularly young consumers. You're right. What's really important for them is the provenance, which is constantly evolving.
That was Pat Dombey, VP and Head of Corporate Affairs and Government Relations at the De Beers Group of Companies. For more on the company's sustainability framework and commitment to ethical sourcing of diamonds, check out our podcast feed for our full conversation.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, the Bloomberg 50 is unveiled. We're going to break down the list of people and ideas that defined global business over the past year.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, and it's not just because of the holidays. It's also the fifth installment of Bloomberg Business Week's Bloomberg 50. It's a list of 50 people and trends that deserve recognition in business, entertainment, finance, politics, science, and tech, Tim, for 2021.
Where else are you going to find Britney Spears, the CEOs of Ford and CVS, and even the meme stock? Ted Lasso is on there too. Here with a look at how it all comes together and who made the list this year is Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. Also, Bloomberg Business Week features editor Brett Biegun. Joel, I want to start with you. We know Brett is the Bloomberg 50 maven, but give us some background on the issue and really how it got started.
So we've long wanted to do an issue that kind of looks back at the most important people of the year. And we've been doing this. This is the fifth annual year that we've done it, fifth annual issue. And one of the things that I think really distinguishes our list is the idea that we obsess around data, and that every person or idea that makes it onto the list has some distinguished metric from the year that makes them interesting. And that's different. Like, you could put Warren Buffett on a list like this almost any given year as a very important person in business. But we really hone in on a tangible thing from the year that really distinguishes someone. And once you've been on the list, you can't be on it again. So the other thing that I think the list affords is this real amazing sense of discovery. We're always looking for up-and-comers who are breaking through. And, you know, because business is ever-changing, there's never a dearth of options. And this list starts as this massive spreadsheet and just gets narrowed down until we get the most impactful 50 people and that comes together in this amazing issue.
So, Brett, how early do you start working on this list in the year? Because I know that there's emails that go out, and you really tap the network that is Bloomberg.
I mean, are you already thinking about 2022?
Too soon.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Too soon. It starts pretty early. I mean, basically, we start at the end of the second quarter, because at that point, you have a pretty good sense of sort of what's happened in the first half of the year, and there are some sort of no-brainers at that point. So they get on sort of what I'd call like they're sort of VIP. They get in sort of very early special access to the list. But we really canvass reporters all across the world. I mean, in Asia and Europe and Middle East, Africa and the Americas. And, you know, to Joel's point, we're looking for the people that had the most impact in their field. There's a lot of people that have impact, but we want to make sure we're really getting, you know, the CEOs of the companies that had the most impressive IPOs or made the most impressive acquisitions, or the people in entertainment who had really sort of the absolute biggest years. And then we also look for serendipity. You know, we look for people, as Joel said, that you may not have heard of, and then we can like to combine that with people that you may have heard of, but maybe you don't know why they'd make the list in that particular year.
I always wonder if there's a year like where it's really tough to, like, you're like, oh my God, there's so many really good people, and you've got to just make some cuts.
Every single time. And part of what we're trying to do here is look at a mix too. Mm-hmm. Obviously, finance, this is Bloomberg, pretty easy to figure out who were some important people in the finance world. Ditto business. But we also try and, you know, reach out, look at science and entertainment. And really have this feeling like when you look across the list, we mean business in many, many, many different senses.
So can you tell us who didn't make the list?
Well, wow, to that end, I think there are a couple things that
I just got to give you an idea of my thinking behind this question, Joel and Brett, because I kind of imagine this smoke-filled room, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
But it looks a lot like Get Back, you know, where Brett and I are sitting around smoking cigarettes.
Or maybe a smoke-filled
Zoom. Like horse
Zoom
trading?
Yeah.
This day and age.
So we have two things that...
And like you're like fighting for your person to get on, right?
We have a couple of things that we do to account for that. One is a thing that we call the usual suspects. And that accounts for the Warren Buffetts or the Jeff Bezoses, which... You could basically do those people almost any given year, right? We also have the alums page because there are people who have fantastic years who we've featured before. And, you know, obviously it's like if we come back and do the same people again and again, then the list gets static and it's not fun. So, but we still think that those people are worth honoring. And then the other near and dear one is what we call ones to watch, which are maybe they haven't had a huge breakthrough. Oftentimes they're a little bit younger. And there are people that we think either next year or in years to come could be people that crack the regular Bloomberg 50 list.
Yeah, and like someone, I mean, I'll just give you an example, like someone like Letitia James, right? She was not on the list this year because she was on the list last year. We don't repeat. But I would say probably 7 or 8 people pitched her, you know, as being on the list. So someone like that who's running for governor of New York, who publishes this 168-page bombshell report, you would think, yeah, should be on the list, but was already on. So we put her in the alum section.
And it makes sense, though, because her 2021 was, I think, perhaps a lot more impactful to more people than her 2020.
And I guess we should actually talk about some of the people on the list, you know. Albert Bourla was the one that came to mind, CEO of Pfizer. And you know, you would have maybe thought that he was on last year's list, except this was the year that they actually started to deliver it and basically created the biggest success in the history of pharma. So I think last year's list was very COVID-centric. We had a lot of amazing people. We had a lot of group entries because of that. And this year, I think we tried to focus a little bit more on people. And I will segue more into the list right now, because one of the other things we try and do that I think is just really fun is always make room for an inanimate object.
Like a chicken sandwich?
Well, yes! You know, the Popeye's chicken sandwich did crack it in 2019. Last year, we had the SPAC, which proved as relevant this year as last year. We were just ahead of the time. Perhaps we helped make the SPAC. Brett, what was this year's inanimate object?
Not the chicken sandwich this year, but we did the meme stocks.
You couldn't get a chicken sandwich. There was supply chain shortages.
But plenty of meme stocks.
That's right. Plenty of meme stocks. Actually, you know, if you look at the 50 that Robinhood put on their restricted list, there was $150 billion worth of market cap created early in the year in January, you know, based on these meme stocks. So we're trying to figure out exactly, you know, what to do here. Should we put GameStop on the list? Should we put AMC on the list?
Yeah. Should we put the CEOs of those companies on the list?
The CEOs of those companies on the list.
Who did nothing.
They didn't do anything, right? So then we said, why don't we ask Matt Levine what he wants to do? And Matt Levine said, sure, I'll be happy to write a piece for you about the meme stock and the year in meme stocks. And, you know, Matt really, like, focuses in here on, I guess it's sort of the psychology of community, really, and the psychology of belonging and the way in which... the meme stock was something that people were sitting at home in the pandemic without being able to really go out. And there's a community of people, and they were having fun, and they were buying the stock. And some people just like the stock, and they bought it for that reason. But Matt talks a lot about community and value, and it's really like a wonderful piece, and really sort of makes you think about this in a different light.
Well, speaking about community, there was a community of junior bankers over at Goldman Sachs. That also made the list.
Yeah, so mostly anonymous. We ended up getting the name of one of them. Bloomberg News broke that earlier in the year. But what they rallied for ended up becoming this galvanizing force on Wall Street, not only at Goldman, but you know just across the whole community. And has led to some changes. And funny enough, and we did a cover story to this effect earlier in the year. They didn't ask for more money, but that's basically what they got. Wall Street brought out the money cannon to sort of make amends a little bit more.
Yeah, and they also looked at things like maybe you don't have to work all weekend. Maybe you can have one day sort of kind of off. But yeah, I mean, to Joel's point, that this PowerPoint presentation that went viral in March led to new, you know, base pays at a lot of these companies. But the other thing that it did is it just sort of brought attention to some of the mental health problems that were occurring. They were sort of a self-diagnosis of mental health conditions that were going on, and at least that was sort of brought to light, and it was given its due.
Do you think there will be perhaps permanent effects of these junior bankers, not just within finance but in other industries as well?
I think it's entirely possible that they started a really important conversation in an area or field that conversation just hadn't really been happening in. So I think it's the beginning. You know, we'll still have to see where it goes, but I certainly think that that's possible.
There's a prominent CEO, female CEO too, that you guys brought recognition to, and we're talking about Karen Lynch over at CVS.
So this was a really interesting one because at the beginning of the year, she got this job, and we were immediately interested in it because of the role that pharmacies were going to have in the distribution of vaccines, at least especially here in the U.S. Highest ranking female executive in the U.S. When she took over. And this was the part that shocked me. CVS, fifth largest public company by sales. So this is a huge company. And what I thought was really interesting, we did a Q&A with her. That was another thing that we did in the issue, is start to play with some different formats. And Angelica Levito did the interview with her. And what it revealed to me was sort of where she wants to take CVS. You would think of it as a pharmacy, maybe in the context of the vaccine distribution. It is her goal and her vision strategy is to become much more of the center of your healthcare universe.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We know we're going to get more from you guys a little bit later on.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber and Businessweek features editor Brett Biegun.
That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Businessweek from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenebeck. Ahead in our next hour, the president of Shopify on a hot start to the holiday shopping season, the VP of Cadillac discussing the next stage of the luxury brand's EV transformation, and the CEO of Build-A-Bear Workshop on why there's more room to run after a record quarter and a soaring share price.
Plus, we're going to have more of this year's Bloomberg 50. We're going to finally get to Brittany. I can't wait. We're going to put that year, this year, 2021, in perspective. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including an American luxury car brand's place in the electric vehicle revolution. We're talking about Cadillac.
And a small cap toy maker is rewarding shareholders on the heels of a blowout earnings report. Build-A-Bear Workshop CEO Sharon Price John on what's next for a company whose shares are up about 400% year to date.
Talk about a rally.
Talk about a lot of bears.
Plus, more from our annual Bloomberg 50 list. This week's issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine dedicated to the individuals and ideas that have defined 2021.
First up this hour, an e-commerce power player has a strong start to the holiday shopping season. Shopify came out earlier this week with data saying that its merchant sales from Black Friday through Cyber Monday hit a record $6.3 billion. That represents a 23% increase compared with the same period a year earlier.
But what's interesting, Tim, is those figures contrast with some of the broader retail trends that we've seen so far in the early portion of the holiday shopping season. We caught up with Shopify president Harley Finkelstein and asked him how the cloud-based commerce platform was able to overcome an otherwise lackluster weekend from consumers.
I think what you were seeing is that Shopify merchants really outpaced the industry at frankly these astonishing rates, and they continue to do so through the entire weekend. We know that consumer spending has stayed strong, but I don't think BFCM was simply just a measure of consumer confidence. It seems like it was also a barometer for consumer interest in supporting independent brands and entrepreneurs, and we think that support is stronger than ever. For the entire weekend, so from Friday to Monday, we saw about $6.3 billion sold sales on Shopify. That's about 23% growth, as you mentioned. And about 47 million consumers made a purchase from a Shopify merchant during the weekend. The other thing that's really interesting is that average cart size was up from about $90 to about $100 globally. And when you look at, you know, where those sales were coming from, of course we had the big names that we always talk about here, you know, companies like Allbirds and Bombas and Gymshark and Brooklyn. But we also saw some new names emerge, The Nugget, for example, Our Place, for example, and then some traditional retailers that use Shopify like Lego, Mattel, Spanx, Dockers. But I really, you know, relative to the numbers that you were mentioning earlier from the industry, industry-wide, it feels like this is a tale of two different retail worlds. On one side, you have traditional big box stores, but then you have direct to consumer.
Well, let me just remind our listeners of those numbers from Adobe. So U.S. shoppers spent $10.7 billion on Cyber Monday. That's according to Adobe, less than the $10.8 billion a year earlier. And that missed Adobe's estimate of $11.3 billion. So Harley, it sounds like the analysis that you're providing is it's because it's a different type of shopping happening. You're saying that Shopify, retailers that use the Shopify platform outperformed the industry, and that's why you see the dichotomy and the divergence with the data from Adobe.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think, you know, Adobe's first of all only looking at the U.S., where Shopify is a global platform. We have more than 1.7 million stores across 175 countries. But what we really did see is that consumers unequivocally voted with their wallets this past four-day weekend to buy from independent retailers and their favorite brands. And, you know, some of these brands have now become really incumbents. If you look at companies like Figs or Allbirds, these are stores that started on Shopify just a couple years ago, and now they're publicly traded companies. And so I think you're going to see more of this happening, where the future retail really does belong to these independent direct-to-consumer brands, as opposed to the big-box retailers, in some cases, that aren't really adding any real value.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, we talk about innovation, as you know, Harley, so much in so many different industries, certainly in technology. We've seen it in retail in a big way. What does that mean then, you think, for the major retailers that are out there versus many of those that are on your platform? Is there something more significant going on in terms of the retail trends?
Well, look, I've been a student of retail and commerce for the majority of my life. And I think one of the major changes that have happened here is that a lot of the retailers that were reselling other people's products simply weren't justifying their profit margin. So, you know, I'm sitting here right now in Canada wearing my favorite T-shirt, which is James Purse, which is a Shopify store. Years ago, I was able to buy a James Purse T-shirt at Barney's, for example, and I never did. And the reason was I didn't feel that I was getting a better experience, and it was certainly more expensive buying from Barney's. Whereas when I go to jamespurse.com, powered by Shopify, I get a much better experience. I know that the money that I'm paying for is a vote with my wallet that I want more of those brands to exist in the world. I think the other thing is that the big box retailers, for a very long time, they had an unfair advantage because they had distribution. And the reason that we were going to these big box stores is because they were in our cities. But the internet has completely democratized distribution, so that today I can be sitting anywhere in the world, and for $29, I can set up a store on Shopify, and I can sell online, I can sell offline, I can sell on TikTok or Spotify or Instagram, and I can be default global within a matter of minutes. That's where technology is driving this really incredible innovation in commerce.
How do you make sure that these companies, as they grow, don't graduate from Shopify's platform and they're able to keep using it?
It's a great question. The challenge of being able to make it really easy for any brand or any entrepreneur or business to get started on Shopify, and then when they get to some sort of scale, they continue to grow, that is really what makes Shopify quite unique. So, for example, you know, when you're just getting started, you may just simply want to set up a very simple online store and sell to consumers. But as you grow, you begin to wanting to sell across a variety of different places, channels. I mentioned Instagram and Facebook, but also you want to sell across new channels that emerge. We announced a partnership 2 weeks ago with Spotify, so that artists on Spotify can open online stores on Shopify and sell merchandise.
That was Shopify President Harley Finkelstein.
And we should note that this past week, after a conversation with Harley, a group of five educational publishers sued Shopify. The group includes Pearson Education and McGraw-Hill. It filed for copyright and trademark infringement.
Just as we were putting our broadcast to bed, Shopify had declined to comment on the specifics of the lawsuit, saying that it takes actions against web stores that violate its policies.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, one of America's premier luxury auto brands is racing into the EV market.
The question is, how fast can it shift gears? This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So check out the EV market. We've got Tesla now ranked as the world's most valuable car company by far. Rivian sporting the second highest market cap among U.S. car makers, despite Tim having generated no sales revenue as of yet.
Meantime, General Motors plans to double its revenue by 2030 as it looks to ultimately convert to an all-EV lineup. And CEO Mary Barra recently said that she expects GM to catch up to Tesla in electric vehicle sales by as soon as 2025.
Those efforts include GM's iconic luxury brand. We're talking about Cadillac. Now, you might recall back in September, GM opened reservations for its 2023 Cadillac Lyriq electric SUV. And after just 10 minutes, they were gone.
To find out what sets the first-of-its-kind model apart, what the future holds for its gas-powered engines, and how Cadillac is navigating supply chain constraints and labor shortages in a competitive car market, we spoke with the brand's vice president, Rory Harvey.
I think there's lots of different data sources. I'm sure that you have access to many of them that extrapolate what is going to happen with EV adoption. And from our perspective, we think now that the time is right absolutely to put our foot on the accelerator pedal. We have a great portfolio today of ICE vehicles, but we think now is the time to complement that with switching to EV.
So, Rory, I'm going to ask a different question in that. Why is it going to take to 2030? Mm-hmm. Why not sooner, especially when you've got, you know, a company like Tesla that has definitely at this point is out front and center and has the first mover advantage? They're now ranked as the world's most valuable car company by far. You've got Rivian sporting the second highest market cap among U.S. car makers despite having no sales revenue yet. I mean, that's a topic for another conversation. So I'm just curious, you know, why not try and do it sooner rather than later? Is it logistically it's just got to take this amount of time?
No, I think it's balancing basically what we need to do, what we need to do in terms of market opportunity with our ICE vehicles, what we need to do in terms of EVs. So as an example, if you looked at the Lyriq, which will be the first EV in terms of luxury crossover from Cadillac, we pulled that forward by 9 months. So we brought that forward and accelerated it to the back end of March in 2022. That will be followed by the Celestiq, which will be an ultra luxury brand. And indeed, you know, without giving the timing away of all of the product portfolio, if you look at GM across the board, we will have 30 products by 2025 that are EV variants, with about 60% of those sold in the US. So there is a fairly aggressive introduction of the EVs moving forward. I guess the 2030 timescale is the period of time when we will be selling the last ICE vehicles from a Cadillac perspective. But we will certainly be in the market much earlier than that, complementing our ICE vehicle sales with EV vehicles.
You know, Tim and I talk, Rory, a lot about wanting our next car to be an electric vehicle. Tim lives in the city. I live just outside the city. In the urban environment, you do wonder about, okay, how the heck am I going to charge this puppy? How much of your timing also is thinking about the bigger, broader infrastructure problems that I feel like we've been talking about for a few years, that in order for EVs to really come, you need to have the EV support network to be there as well, especially when it comes to charging?
You're absolutely right, Carol. I mean, that's fundamental. And if you look at some of the metropolitan areas, you know, there's a big push in terms of infrastructure. If you look at some of the legislation and some of the activities that the states are putting in place, you know, the momentum is really starting to build. But it's a fundamental issue in terms of being able to facilitate demand with customer convenience. And from that point of view, you know, there's a number of things that we're doing, whether it be working with our dealer partners to put charging stations in place. We made an announcement the week before last in terms of that. Whether it be our mobile app, which basically gives customers the ability to be able to determine where to charge, which chargers are up and running, minimum downtime, etc. But it is one of the challenges that the industry faces in terms of ensuring, particularly in some of those densely populated areas, that the infrastructure is there. So, again, that's part of the reason that at the moment we have the need to be able to satisfy customers from an ICE vehicle perspective, but also from an EV perspective.
Hey, Rory, when it comes to battery charging stations, how much of it is the private sector responsibility? How much is it public sector? Is it a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's down to the incentives that are available. It's down to the distribution. It's down to private companies because there's a business opportunity. It's down to public. I think this one is a team effort in terms of putting the infrastructure in place.
Hey, Rory, you know, I'm thinking about GM and their all in on electric vehicles. Cadillac, obviously a key part of that component. I am curious about, in the transitioning, especially at a time where we're talking so much about supply chains, are you guys able at this point to get all the raw materials, the minerals and things that you need to easily and continue to make this transition and keep to your timeline?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple of parts to that. So I'll answer it first in terms of relating to semiconductors, which is one of the challenges that the global automotive industry is facing today. So
You know, that has been a challenge throughout the course of 2021, and it's still a challenge today. Having said that, I would say that, you know, we are seeing a better flow of chips now. There's been a terrific amount of work that has been done with the supply chain, indeed getting more involved and deeper into the supply chain to be able to secure the right level of supply of chips moving forward. It is going to continue into 2022. But as an example, if you looked at North America and our plants in North America, we've got the majority of them for General Motors back up and running. And indeed, as of Monday of this week, every single Cadillac plant in North America is now operational. So that's step one in terms of getting inventories to recover so that we can fulfill what is very strong customer demand at the moment. So we're looking forward to some stability coming during the course of 2022 there. Then in addition, in terms of the materials that are required going forward in terms of batteries, again, we've made some recent announcements in terms of some of the ventures and infrastructures that we're putting in place to ensure that we can secure the right levels of supply to enable and support the transition as we need to. And at this particular point in time, there is absolutely no delays to our EV platforms in terms of rollout schedule. Indeed, I mentioned earlier that we're looking to pull the Lyriq ahead by 9 months versus the original plan. So we will start producing that vehicle in March of 2022.
It's interesting. As we move through this shift, what is it that is the major risk to it progressing as you hope when you look at, you know, your timeline? And as you said, you moved it up for the Lyriq. But what is the biggest risk to all of this?
Yeah, I think, one of the challenges that you've got, I'm not sure if I describe it as a risk, is the pace of change and the rate of adoption, the rate of infrastructure, the range anxiety, customers' ability to be able to charge, etc. So I think there's a number of elements that piece together in terms of the jigsaw. And I wouldn't say that it's a risk overall in terms of the change. I would say it's a timing impact in terms of how aggressive is the adoption rate of EVs going to be. So I think it's more in terms of a question as to when rather than if.
That was Cadillac Vice President Rory Harvey.
Your next car, an electric one?
I think so.
I know we talk about infrastructure, especially in the city, right? Plugging in. Like, what do you do?
That's the thing, Carol. And I got flack for this. I've talked about this before on our program.
Yeah.
Because I've said it's difficult for people who live in cities who park on streets, which is a lot of people who live in apartment buildings who don't have garages, like me. Like, where would we charge it?
No, it's a really good point. You have to figure that out.
It's so rare in New York City to walk down the street and actually see a place where you can charge a car. We have a couple in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, but they're always being used.
We got to figure that one out. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, Build-A-Bear Workshop. It's a small cap company that just posted a record-breaking third quarter performance. Its stock on a tear.
We're going to speak with CEO Sharon Price John. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
If you're looking for an outperformer in the stock market, check out shares of Build-A-Bear Workshop. That stock, Tim, up in the area of around 400% this year.
This past week, the company reported record revenues of more than $95 million in the third quarter. They also authorized $25 million worth of share buybacks. All this as Build-A-Bear prepares to celebrate its 25th anniversary in the new year.
Sharon Price John has been the firm's president and CEO since 2013. She had previously racked up 2 decades worth of experience in marketing and product development with the likes of Hasbro, Mattel, and StrideRight.
And now she's got the specialty retailer of customized stuffed animals soaring to new heights in the midst of the busy holiday season. Sharon joined us from the New York Stock Exchange to discuss the company's digitization plans and its banner quarterly results.
As you mentioned, we declared a special dividend and authorized that stock buyback program, but also raised annual guidance. And, we're looking at a revenue number that's the best in about a decade, as well as that pre-tax income that I was speaking of. That's the best in our corporate history for the third quarter and the first 3 quarters of the year.
One thing I just wanted to ask you, Sharon, is why the buyback, why the special dividend? Is that the best way to use some of your cash on hand?
Well, it's one way to use our cash on hand. We have a robust capital plan, and a portion of that we felt with these record earnings is just a great opportunity for us to directly and immediately return some of that value to our shareholders. Of course, the stock buyback has a much different purpose. It's more of a recognition of the board noting and believing in the future of the company. We also outlined some strategic objectives and opportunities for the future and how we're investing, and that's inclusive of continued and acceleration of our digital transformation, as well as the evolution of our retail footprint and the way we go to market and continue to push into the more robust approach to omnichannel. I know that people don't always recognize the Build-A-Bear as an online retailer, but as with many, through the COVID experience, we really did lean heavily into e-commerce. Mm-hmm. We had already been on that road from a strategic perspective for a number of years.
How much of your business is e-commerce versus store?
Well, you know, but Build-A-Bear's now, which is important to understand, Build-A-Bear's now multi-generational.
Yeah.
So we're coming up on our 25th year. Don't let that make you feel old. We've just been around for a while, and that's okay, because not only do parents now want to take their kids, they actually want to experience Build-A-Bear again. And some of that is our collectibles product, like Pokemon or Harry Potter, and they go online. So our business just a few years ago was more in the 4-5% range of total sales, and now it's up to 20%.
And what's the goal? How high do you want to get that?
Well, we're really, the key is to grow total revenue. And because e-commerce for us is it's on par from a profitability perspective to the rest of our revenue in stores, we just want to be there the way guests want to interact with us. If they want to go online and purchase, they can do that. If they'd like to come in store and have that very special retailtainment experience that we're famous for, they can do that too.
Hey, got to ask you, which we ask every leader of an institution or organization or company, supply chain issues. How rough is it for you guys?
Yeah, you know, we, like so many toy industry people, we do source from Southeast Asia, and it has been a challenge. And, you know, we're juggling containers and products and reprioritizing on a regular basis. We did make a special note that we believe we have a really strong inventory position for the remainder of the holiday season. We feel like that we have done our projections appropriately, and really importantly, particularly for that special experience and memory that people want to make in our stores, we actually have enough bear builders, which would be our sales associates, to make sure to the best of our ability that everybody has that great Build-A-Bear moment.
That's Sharon Price John, president and CEO of Build-A-Bear Workshop. She says, hey, they're going to be able to satisfy demand this holiday season.
It's interesting, too. I love these like kind of traditional kids toy shops or traditional retailers that are diversifying. I mean, they've got an entertainment division that just released its first live action production as part of Hallmark's Christmas movie lineup. I've got to say, we had a ton of stuffies growing up. It was something that my daughter really, really loved. But it's interesting
just
to see.
Just your daughter? Or you too, Carol?
Are you going to like?
No, I'm not going to blow up your spot. But you had some Build-A-Bears, right?
I have to say, I like teddy bears.
It's okay.
Had some old ones, a little collection,
okay.
And then she inherited them. But it is interesting to see how they are more interactive in their stores. And she talked a lot about the adult component of their business. It's not just about kids, Tim.
It's not. I know. Everybody needs their stuffies,
I'm blushing right? For everybody on radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we turn our attention back to our cover story in the Bloomberg 50. We'll dig deeper into our list of the year's most influential people and ideas.
This is where we get to talk about Britney, right?
Britney and Beamstocks.
And Ted Lasso.
That's right.
We're getting to it in just a moment. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So the newest issue of Bloomberg Business Week commemorates the fifth year of the Bloomberg 50. It's our annual look at those in business, entertainment, finance, politics, science, and technology whose accomplishments deserve some recognition.
To highlight a few more of the standouts, we welcome back the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, along with Business Week features editor Brett Biegun. Well, let's acknowledge an honoree that really stood out to me on the list, somebody who really risked everything at a crucial moment in U.S. history that was really at the start of the year, Eugene Goodman.
So this was one that really, when Brett and I started the conversations, it was like almost was on the list from the get-go, right?
Yeah.
Because here was this person in the middle of this, the quagmire of January 6th, as you were trying to understand even what was happening. But in the aftermath, we learned that there were some heroes. And Eugene Goodman, one of the Capitol security officers who actually probably saved lives because of his actions in terms of distracting and leading away some of the insurgents, which saved valuable time for the people who were inside and were able to actually secure some doors and perhaps, you know, again, save lives. So Eugene Goodman has been utterly quiet about all of this. We reached out multiple times to try and talk to him about the day and the events and the aftermath, because keep in mind there have been multiple Capitol police officers who have actually taken their own lives in the months since. And he was quiet and did not want to participate. And one of the things that we also learned is that Bloomberg News had people there on the ground who were covering this, Billy House being one of them. Billy had also not talked about that day. So we used this as a way of talking about Eugene Goodman, but also Billy's experience, not only covering the events of that day and you know, being Congress a reporter for years now, but also the role that the Capitol police officers play in the daily coverage. And he has these nice little asides about how he talks to these guys for years, right? And you almost just take them for granted until all of a sudden they're actually there to do their jobs and protect you. And so I thought it was just an encapsulation of these quiet American heroes at obviously one of the darkest hours of our nation's history.
Yeah, I mean, you think about Hero and you really, that video, is chilling. And every time I see it, I feel like those of us who just saw the video outside for a long time, and then once we saw that video inside, you realize, okay, this was a whole other thing.
And Billy actually didn't even know about that, because he was there on the ground kind of living it. So, yeah. You know, he doesn't even really remember when he saw that the video of Goodman that went viral, right? But that was the, you know, for him to be on the other side of the building and living his own version of it, that was what we tried to weave all together there.
We want to talk a little bit more about some of the kind of non-business types. How hard is it, or is it easier to put this list, or do you have a lot more names that come in when it comes to the people that are kind of the non-traditional business, kind of Wall Street people we cover here at Bloomberg?
I think it's all about that mix. You want to have people that you expect and then some unexpected ones. So Eugene Goodman maybe doesn't have much to do about business in the traditional sense, except how could you do this list and not honor someone like that? One of the most important, I think, moments of the year. Brett, how do you think about putting that mix together so we have the right balance of business and sort of curiosity?
Yeah, I think you want there to be a sense of discovery, right? I mean, any good magazine issue, you open it up and things should feel familiar and other things should not feel familiar. And you say, I didn't know about that. And we think about that with entertainment, right? I mean, that's not a thing that we cover business of entertainment, but entertainer is not always a thing that we cover. So, you know, someone like, I look at like someone on the list like Gia Ling, not a household name at all, certainly outside of China, but her movie High Mom is the highest grossing film ever for a female director. She supplanted Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman this year. I don't think most people know that.
No.
Probably because the film didn't do much outside of China, but it was a massive, massive hit in the country. So someone like that, yeah, we want to put someone like that on the list. But the thing that I really look for, I think especially in entertainment, is what's the larger story that's being told here, right? So someone like Olivia Rodrigo, yes, she had massive success this year. But the cool thing about her is she became immediately famous everywhere in the world at the same time, almost instantaneously. That is a new model. You know, even people like her that came out of the sort of Disney factory, we can talk about maybe, you know, Britney Spears or something like that.
We're going to get
awesome list. But she came out of Disney but didn't tour, puts out this single driver's license, and she was immediately as popular in the Philippines as she was here. And that's what streaming and basically social media can do now. So we also look for people where there's sort of a story behind the story.
So let's talk about Britney Spears.
Let's go there.
Because as we have been talking about when it comes to this list, you'd be hard-pressed to find another list that included diverse characters such as CEOs and meme stocks and Britney Spears. How did she make the list?
It's kind of like, how could she not?
Honestly,
this year?
just a huge fan trying to find a way to put her on the list. I mean,
we all know what happened with when it came to the battle that she's waged with her father. But I think it's notable that she was a household name 20 years ago, and now she's back in the spotlight for something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, the Free Britney movement had gotten a lot of attention. You know, this was a group of supporters that both outside of the courthouse, she's having these hearings, and also especially online, was getting a lot of attention. There was a New York Times documentary about this. I got a lot of attention as well. And, you know, I'm not even sure that I was really paying attention to this whole saga until I started to read about this stuff. And then you start to pay attention. You think, oh, my God, like this is a crazy – this is a business story because for years – she is making millions of dollars for the managers of the conservatorship. And she goes to testify in court in June saying that, you know, basically she doesn't have a passport. She's not allowed to remove an IUD. I mean, really incredible things. And that was in June. And you know, basically in August, the courts basically says that her father has to sort of step down. He does so in September, and by November the conservatorship is dissolved. It sounds like it's not a business story, but it really is.
Well, it's also, I mean, we play so much into media content. Like, you think about the role of social media or these films that were done. I have to say, I binged a bunch over Thanksgiving on all this Britney stuff, having seen snippets of it, and it was pretty powerful. And as a society, we all kind of had to ask some questions about what was going on.
Yeah, and in addition to that, I mean, there's several politicians now who are saying, hey, we really need to look at the laws around this, because this is kind of crazy.
So I think that's an example of just something that has impact. You might not associate it immediately as a business story, and yet there are millions of dollars that are wrapped up in something like this. And you know, think about what this visibility this brings to this style of of cases. So I just think it was a really, to Tim's point, you know, she could have been on this list 20 years ago, but like also there's a reason and a zeitgeist moment that happened here, and this was an example of it. And I'll segue from that into another one, also has to deal with some court cases. Earlier this year, the NCAA basically had to step out of this business of telling athletes, college athletes, that they couldn't make money off their name, image, likeness. These NIL deals now are huge because it allows, you know, college athletes who previously wouldn't have been able to profit to actually make money off of themselves. And it was really interesting. Brett and I spent a lot of time trying to find the right way to frame this one. And we landed on an athlete named Paige Beckers. Who's Paige Beckers?
Paige Beckers, a.k.a. Paige Buckets. Paige is a shooting guard at the University of Connecticut, which obviously has turned out a long line of very successful college basketball players, Diana Taurasi, Brianna Stewart. But she came along at the right time. She's a superstar. She has a massive social media following. She's super cool. She's just awesome. And she is among the more high-profile athletes in college right now who are taking advantage of these name, image, and likeness deals. So on Monday, Bloomberg News earlier this week reported that she signed a big deal with Gatorade. That's her first major sponsor, and that she's the first athlete that Gatorade has ever sponsored in college. But the even sort of cooler deal that she has is with this company called StockX, which is this online streetwear marketplace. And the deal with StockX is going to allow her to do a lot of branded collaborations. So there could be Paige Beckers t-shirts, or really more importantly, maybe Paige Beckers sneakers. And the reason that she wanted this deal is that it's going to allow her to get some real hard data. So when she enters the WNBA, presumably 3 years from now, and the brands come to her and say, well, you know, female athletes, they don't really generate the same sales that the men do. She'll say, actually, here are the receipts, right? Here you go. Take a look. I can sell shoes. And so this was really kind of like a political act for her. She was very intentional about making sure that she had a deal that was going to allow her to sort of go to the major brands once she graduated and say, look, I can sell shoes, so don't ask for a discount.
And this all goes back to her having just this rabid social following, you know, like more than a million followers between TikTok and Twitter and whatnot. So it just does speak to like the ability of a person, and a person who wouldn't have otherwise been able to crack our Bloomberg 50 list, to kind of take control of her own future a little bit. And I find that just totally empowering.
Well, guys, amazing work as always when it comes to this list. Thank you so much for your time and, of course, for your efforts on it. I know it is a lot of work. A double dose of Joel Weber and Brett Biegun helping us break down the Bloomberg 50 for 2021.
All right, that's going to wrap up our weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. YouTube, just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week, available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com, at BusinessWeek.com, and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT, and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.